Session number 14806, Eddie Murray, part 27.
And so Churchill could hear them. How did he write his speeches? They mentioned on this program that he had said once to somebody that he could write a most rousing speech by listening to military music and also drinking a bottle of scotch. When he did it,
they do talk such rubbish, don't they?
I don't know.
But
he's quoted once as saying it would take him 3 hours to write a one-hour speech, or 3 hours to write a two-hour speech. Would it take him 6 hours to write a half-hour speech? All words to that effect. Anyway, his speech writing—how did that work?
Yeah, well, of course,
he used to lock himself away, or
no, he used to be up in the office upstairs, and he'd have. He'd call for one of the secretaries, sometimes in bed, when he was in bed,
yes.
Because he never usually got up before 12 o'clock. And one of the secretaries would come up and take shorthand notes. He would dictate to the secretary. Then they'd go downstairs, type it out in on that old-fashioned typewriter, which gave quite good size 10, I suppose, on a computer. In quite large type, and they had a special way of writing these things, and each phrase would sort of be separated by a couple of spaces, so each phrase or each maybe combination of phrases of four or five lines would be separated by two or three lines of space.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was a regular practice. And so they'd go downstairs and type it out on, it's half of A4, I don't know what size that is.
Mm-hmm. A5.
Is it?
That's little, what it is. Yeah, that's, I suppose, yes, ones. Anyway.
And then they would make a hole in the top left-hand corner and then insert one of these little strings with things on the end so that each page could be turned over separately and still remain there without falling on the floor. And this would come back to him, and then he'd go through it and talk it through, and she would have a copy of it, of course, and she would she wouldn't have a copy. She would just sit there and listen and take notes, and he would have his red pencil there or red pen. And as he went through the notes, he would scratch things out or add notes on the right-hand side or the left-hand side. There's plenty of space because of these spaces in between the paragraphs, you see. And so there's always plenty of room for him to make corrections. And this is how they would go downstairs again, be typed out and come back again. And then he would go through it. And probably after the third time, he would go to lunch or maybe go down to the lounge where Lady Churchill would be, and he'd hand it over to Lady Churchill, and she would go through it and suggest improvements in the presence of a secretary. And so it would be gradually altered and tampered with.
Mm.
But even, you know, the first one would have made, there's no doubt about it, an absolutely wonderful speech. For anybody else. But nevertheless, it had to be absolutely perfect. And then, you know, after it was practically terminated to everybody's, Lady Churchill and his own, and the Secretary Montagu Brown was also very, very important in these speeches. Prior to Montagu Brown, there was Jock Colville and other secretaries who were there. And so the whole process, of course, had been going on for years and years and years. But this was the way that it went. Starting in bed and finishing up at the luncheon table and even carrying on until dinner time and after dinner, after a cinema show, which would terminate perhaps at 10:30, 11 o'clock, and it would go on until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning.
Really?
And he would always be working. And he worked very, very hard on each and every speech, whether it was just a speech of 30 minutes or a speech of 2 hours.
Mm-hmm. How long did it? Did he started working about a week beforehand, or how long? 2 weeks, or how long? He used to.
This was always directed, if you like, by the immediacy of the thing. There were things that cropped up, like speeches in the House of Commons, which could crop up immediately after he heard it on the radio, something on the radio, right, or something like that, mm, or in the newspapers that he read when he was in bed in the morning, mm, and then this would incite him to make comments.
And it would, but it would take, normally speaking, several days of, or a day roughly, of fairly intense preparation, would it? Or?
Oh, yes, probably. There were occasions, of course, when he was Prime Minister, when he would even have a secretary with a typewriter sitting beside him. If there were important happenings forthcoming at right. Chequers,
right.
You know.
One of the descriptions, I think, you gave in your book, and also the it was mentioned on the TV series, was puckish. He got a sort of puckish attitude,
yes.
Look.
It's funny that, because, of course, Puck is a Shakespearean character, and he was also this Puck that Shakespeare described so wonderfully was a great character, an amusing character, a cynical, sarcastic character. There's no doubt about that. And I suppose that myself, I'm sure that other people have, in fact, it's in the probably in the dictionary, that to have a puckish smile means that it looks a little sinful, a little naughty, but it's a smile to men. It's still a smile.
Yes.
And Churchill had this wonderful expression where he was sort of half smiling and half glowering, perhaps. It all depends upon which, if you looked at his mouth or if you looked at his eyes. But I feel that when he had this puckish smile, as I still call it, there was also a glint of amusement in his eyes, and he would he'd probably be doing a witticism or a cynical remark or a sarcastic remark, but the smile would remain. And that's why I call it puckish, and other people as well, I'm sure.
Right. You said that...
Devilish.
Devilish. Hmm. And that he used to test people out, and he sort of tested you out when you could see how much
would
put up with in being, well, not messed about, but...
As far as assisting him in the...
In the
painting. Oh, that, not only in painting. I remember the first time when he had prisoners of war working on the farm at Chartwell, and he was recreating, if you like, or creating a more paintable scene, if you like, and taking away big stones and removing walls on the farm and in a big field, to perhaps to taking away hedges to plant other hedges, mm-hmm, in different places.
Yes.
And changing the scene so that it was a landscape,
yes,
rather than just a collection of fields.
Yes, yes.
And he had a wonderful eye for this sort of thing. And I remember, if it only happened once, it wouldn't happen again, because he was sitting there in this wicker chair. I'd driven him down there, and you were talking about a bottle of wine there, a bottle of whiskey. Mm. Never. I mean, a bottle of whiskey would last days and days for Churchill, because there would only be a thimbleful of whiskey and quite a lot of soda to fill the glass up, even although there was that story that goes about Churchill when he was sitting in the smoke room of the House of Commons, and the waiter came and served him his whiskey and soda, and he turned around and he said, waiter! And so the waiter, yes, Sir Winston, tell me, which went in first, the whiskey or the soda? Well, as usual, Sir Winston, the whiskey went in first. Ah, so I may hope eventually to reach it. And so it was always the same, a thimbleful of whiskey,
yes,
but a lot of soda.
Yes.
And there are a lot of thimblefuls. A personal remark, of course, there are never enough thimblefuls of whiskey in a bottle.
Mm.
So his whiskey and soda was always very, very much soda and a little bit of whiskey. And we always took ice. There was a thermos of ice and this seat and a serviette to put under his chin so that he didn't dribble onto his clothes, and a small wicker table. And so there we were. These were all in the back of the car, back of the
Was this what you call lemonade?
This is what I called lemonade.
Right.
And which I would only drink if I were very, very thirsty. But I was always invited.
All right.
You see, I always took two glasses along. And if Lady Churchill, I suppose, saw two glasses going, I would say, well, we never know. You know, that Mr. Montagu Brown or Montague or somebody like that might come along.
Right.
But, no, I think I'm exaggerating a little bit there. And so there we were, in situ, if you like, with him sitting in the wicker chair and this wicker table at the side and his glass of whiskey and soda with ice, which, of course, also made the whiskey weaker.
Sure.
Never, you see, as it melted.
Yeah.
And so there he was, and there was a big stone in front, and he turned round to me on this occasion and said, I'm quite sure that you could move that one, you know. And so, yes, I'm quite sure, Sir Winston, I can move that one, but that's not part of my duties. And, and then perhaps 5 or 10 minutes later, I still feel quite sure that you could move that one, you know. And I remember turning round to him and said, well, the last officer that was here before he went out to Malaya, and I took his job, also suffered from a sprained back because of his answering your requests and trying to move heavy stones, which he shouldn't really have been trying to move. And so he eventually gave up suggesting that I might move it.
Right. And I'd never heard of that prisoners of war working in Chartwell.
Oh, yes.
There
were two there.
Really?
And they'd been there from, you know, immediately after the war.
And what nationality? They were Germans?
Germans.
Really?
Yes. Nice lads.
Yes.
I believe one of them got married eventually in Kent somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But they were good blokes, and hard workers, and they used to enjoy it, and they can't remember where they lived. I think they lived down probably in the Oast House, and they were quite free, really.
When were most PWs repatriated there, I thought?
No, I'm afraid I would have to look into that.
I don't know the answer.
I don't know at all. No, I think it was quite a long time after the end of the war that they were repatriated. I'm talking about 1950, do you see? And so
as far as I was aware, that they left by 1950. I thought the last ones, even the ones who were Nazis, were only sent back after 3 or 4 years. That was the impression I got.
We're talking about Churchill, and the jobs that were to be done were quite numerous, and it was a cheap way of doing it.
Yeah. Were they actually staying on there voluntarily after the war?
I'm sure they were volunteers.
I see.
There's no doubt about that.
Right.
And
they could have gone back home if they wanted to.
Well, I feel that is so.
Mm. Were they in plain clothes or some sort of?
No, I think they had a patch on the back, POW
really?
On the back.
Really? Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How did Churchill treat the Hun then, or?
No, they were well treated, and
yes.
And he knew their Christian names. I can't remember them.
Yeah,
but he would call out if he wanted them to move. They had a bulldozer, and he would call out, you know, instructions to them, and address them by their Christian name.
Really, and how did they treat him?
Oh, they were great admirers.
Really?
Yes, indeed.
Really?
But remember, they were being looked after there, and they were treated well. There's no doubt about
right.
that.
Was he? Could you just go over the daily timetable? I mean, Churchill wouldn't get up till about
midday.
Would he wake up when? About 10 or something? I'm asking.
Oh no, he would be awake at 7 o'clock in the morning.
Right,
half past six, 7 o'clock, and then call for his breakfast. And his breakfast, of course, was normally most substantial, with very often there were lamb chops, for instance, and bacon and egg and, no, not egg. I don't think he cared much for eggs. I know he certainly didn't like soft-boiled eggs. So I can't remember.
Except lamb chops for breakfast.
And fried bread.
Really?
Yes. And sausages, you know.
Together?
Yes, all together. The most substantial breakfast every day.
Really?
Perhaps until the last month of your couple of months of his life.
Really? And so then he used to get out. He
and
used
coffee.
And he used to dictate and so forth, or read the papers or whatever it is from in bed.
Then as soon as the neighbour, as soon as the papers were there, and the valet would go down and get the newspapers from Westerham, because newspapers normally arrive about 5 past 5, 6 o'clock in the morning, you know. And but when he was up in London, the copies of the certainly of the Express and the Telegraph and the Times. I'm not sure about the Times, but certainly the Telegraph and the Express were delivered by Donar dispatch riders at Hyde Park Gate at as early as 7 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
He always had, you know, coffees. And if we were at the Savoy at the other club at midnight, they would be delivered to the Savoy.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
One of those things. But, and so the valet would go down, get the newspapers and bring them back, and he'd probably still just be finishing his breakfast. I said coffee. Now, not having been terribly, very, very often present while he was having breakfast down at Chartwell, even at Hyde Park Gate, I've got a feeling that maybe he took tea. The only time he took tea was at breakfast in the morning.
Right. And he, and then, so he got up about midday.
Midday, yes.
And then he had lunch. And then what?
Lunch was usually, was always 1 o'clock.
Right. And around the stories about him eating, eating, drinking and smoking at the same time while he was eating.
No, breakfast, yes.
Really?
Breakfast, yes.
Yes.
He would have a, but the cigar that he would be smoking then would be in that big ashtray that travelled with him, given to him by Emery Reeves, his continental editor, and it was a great big crystal ashtray, and that, as I said, travelled with him always, and he would, you know, his cigar would be there, smoking or dying out, if you like, while he was having his breakfast. There were occasions, of course, when he'd pick it up just to have a couple of pulls on it to keep it going while, you know, during the half hour that he was having breakfast.
Right. And what were his favourite things to eat at? Like, they mentioned steak and kidney and that sort of thing.
Oh, golly.
Don't know.
I just made out a list of it for America.
Oh, really?
Of all the things. I'll send you a copy.
Okay. Yes.
Because it's a very detailed list.
Right. Did he like plain English food, or did he more like...
Oh, certainly English food.
Yeah, rather than fancy food.
Unless there was Russian caviar, which he didn't often have at home. He had it very often on the Onassis yacht, because it was an expensive item.
Right. Now,
smoked salmon he liked.
Smoked salmon.
And oysters he adored. But not for breakfast.
No. And
hot pot.
Pardon?
Irish hot pot. Irish stew.
Oh, really?
Petit marmite, it's called. You know, it's like a Lancashire hot pot.
Yes. And so then in the afternoon he worked, or he painted, or what did he do?
Oh, he'd always be doing something. Unless there were people to play cards with. And he often played cards in the afternoon with Lady Churchill.
Yes. Okay. Now this is the Chartwell days, not when he was at Number 10 doing the.
That's right. Not when he was at Number 10.
Yeah.
At Number 10, I wasn't really privy to his upstairs rooms, if you like.
Yes, I see. So it was only when he went out, really, that you.
I mean, my office was right at the door there, And so I could see through the window anybody that came to the door.
Mm. In number 10?
Number 10.
On the left or the right?
On the right-hand side as you go in.
Yes.
And and the door was 99 times out of 100, the door would be open so that I could see anybody that came in or even went out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there was always what they called a messenger from the civil service that was there.
Yep. And, go on about the child well thing. And so he would carry on until, and then what would he then do? But he used to have during the war, they used to say that he had a snooze at midday would keep him going, extend his hours of working or whatever.
Yes. Yes, he often had a snooze in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
Until about, it all depended, but normally he would have a snooze before dinner.
All right. Right, before he
got about 5 o'clock.
Before getting
until
up.
Until 7.
Yes.
Half past 7. Then he'd have this very, very hot bath, which was always right up to the top, you know.
Really?
Yes,
swimming in the bath.
Swimming in the bath for the business.
And they'd eat at what? And you said they'd eat and then they'd have the cinema and one thing and another.
Oh, yes. Dinner was usually at 8 o'clock.
Right.
And then, maybe 9:30, when he came, he would come down for the cinema show. There was always a cinema show at Chartwell when he was there every evening.
Really?
And everybody was invited. It was the J. Arthur Rank organization.
Yes.
That used to send the films down.
Yeah.
I've got a feeling they were probably paid for, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember... And this clears up a point that you might have read, or other people might have read, or heard about, when he was in the Middlesex Hospital having hurt his thigh, or his leg in Monte Carlo, and they flew him back in an RAF plane at the Middlesex Hospital. He was so bored with it there in his small room. And he called me in, Sergeant Murray, when the surgeons and doctors were pulling him about a bit on the bed. And I looked on, I couldn't help at all, you know, and he said, and you're permitting them to do this, you know. And I think he was rather cross for me at the time. He thought that I could, I could have assisted in some way.
To restrain,
yes, the doctors. But, he got over that. And then suddenly, do you see, I said to the surgeon, golly, Mr. Next time I met him was in Amsterdam,
mm-hmm.
at Schiphol Airport. But I spoke to him, I said, well, you know, he's bored. If I could perhaps arrange a mini cinema, you know, a screen and a projector. And he thought that, the doctor thought mm-hmm. that was a wonderful mm-hmm. idea. And so I didn't tell the old man, I got in touch with the managing director or something like that,
yes.
of the Rank organization.
Mm-hmm.
And this has never been mentioned that I did all this, do
yes.
you see? This is one of the, you know, somebody else would probably take the glory for it.
Yeah.
But I got in touch with them and he said, yes, Mr. Murray, what a wonderful idea. I'll send one of our managers down. And so a couple of them came and they looked around the room and I said to the old man, we're thinking about organizing a film show for you. And he thought that was brilliant, mm. you see. And so they looked, they measured, and they didn't measure physically, but they looked around and saw the possibilities of that small room.
Mm-hmm.
And probably that same night, or the next night, within a couple of days anyhow, the projector was there, and he had a film show in the evening.
Right.
And there was only room for maybe three or four beside Churchill, other people.
Right. So... just to get back to it, and in fact, that they presumably finished the film show about 11 or something.
Oh, midnight.
Yes, and then he'd carry on working after that.
Oh, he'd carry on working, yes, straight
right.
upstairs.
What we were talking about his favourite foods, what were his, champagne and...
Oh, he liked champagne, yes.
Champagne and...
And Paul Roger, of course, was his preferred. I keep on... mentioning the possibility that it came free from Madame Paul Roger.
Uh-huh.
And I think there's every possibility that it did come.
Right.
We're drinking Paul Roger champagne, as a matter of fact, at the champagne cocktail that we're having at the Imperial War Museum on the 8th.
For the V-Day celebration.
For the celebration.
Right.
And so he liked that. And I think I'm quite sure that most of the time that was his preferred drink at meal time.
Mm.
And he'd have even when he was ill later on and in his declining years, he had a quarter. He would have a quarter of a bottle of champagne.
Really? Mm.
And I've got the last quarter bottle, empty quarter bottle at home, as a matter of fact.
Really? The last empty bottle that he had?
Yeah.
Really?
It was given to me by the valet at the time.
Right.
I didn't pinch it or anything.
No.
It had gone into the dustbin.
Yes.
We didn't know at the time that it was going to be the last one.
No. What sort of films were they just what came out of the latest release, or were they by request?
Occasionally, very occasionally, would be the latest release. He loved the Hornblower series.
Oh yes.
And he loved Vivian Leigh.
Yes.
And Gone with the Wind, Car Gable, and historical thing, romances, historical films, and but not the gushy love stories or anything like that. He just couldn't stand them. Naval episodes.
Military history type.
Military history type, yes.
Yes. Musicals?
Not really, no. I mean, there was an occasion when Frank Sinatra was going to say hello to him, you know, in Monte Carlo.
Yes.
There was Churchill, and I'd asked one of his doctors, he was a sir, he was a knight at the time, and he came through the glass doors, and I went to him, and I asked him if he would, you know, like to sit down and have a scotch with Sir Winston. And he was delighted, and he had a brandy. They had brandies, and I'd moved the chairs and the tables so that they were, you know, nobody could get very close to them. And there was the bar, and I went to the bar. And at the other end of the bar was a person in dinner jacket, and he was having drinks. And then suddenly I saw this person stand up and walk across towards Winston, and I interposed my body in between the two, and can I help you, sir? And so he said, no, that's all right. I'm just going to see my friend Winnie, in an American, very American accent. I'd recognized him, of course. And so I said, well, you know, I'm Detective Sergeant Murray of Scotland Yard, and it's my duty, you know, to be with Sir Winston. And I'm afraid, as you can see, he's very busy in, busily engaged at the present moment in a discussion. And, Horace Evans, it was, Sir Horace Evans. And so I'm afraid, if you'd like to give me, I took a piece of paper out, and if you'd like to give me your name and where you're staying, you might be able to arrange something at a future time. And he looked at me, and if looks could kill, you know, I'd have been dead straight away. And he went out, straight out through the glass doors, and apparently took the first plane to Paris in the United States. It was Frank Sinatra.
Mm.
And so
not a happy man.
Not a happy man. And there were there was always that possibility, do you see? And allow one person to shake him by the hand, that would lead to a whole dozen or so.
Sure.
You know, and it's a very, very tiring process to shake hands with people who are certainly going to ask questions or try to talk to you. And now, why did I go get off the beaten track there?
Well, we're talking about the kind of films that he liked.
Oh, yes.
As far as I can recall.
And so, Frank Sinatra, of course, musicals.
Yeah.
He would not, you know. And so, if it had been Vivian Leigh, for instance,
Well, that would have been different.
Or somebody like Clark Gable, who had been in that sort of a situation, a film that Churchill had watched on occasions, you know, then I wouldn't have hesitated. I'd have asked him to wait a couple of minutes. I'd have told Sir Winston who it was. And, you know, it would have gone on. I'm sure Sir Winston would have been delighted to meet up with... he had Vivian Leigh and Olivier down at Chartwell for lunch, do you see.
What, did he listen to the radio at all, or television?
Oh, no. Radio, practically. Not very often.
What about TV?
And television, no. I remember the first time we watched television, it had been given to him. It was one of these rather large backlit television sets.
Just hang on a second.